Hey, this is Candace Ellis with Diana Dombrowski, and we're here on February 1st, 2012, interviewing Connie Carney about political activism in Gainesville.
It's Connie Canny.
Connie Canny. Did I say Carney?
C-A-N-N-E-Y.
You said Connie Carney.
Okay, Canny. Okay. All right. Well, usually, you know, we like to start right at the beginning, so... if you would start with maybe when and where you were born and maybe describe a little bit about your early life. What did your parents do? We'll start there.
Well, I was born in a little town in New Hampshire called East Rochester. And it was right on the border of Maine on the Salmon Falls River, Maine and New Hampshire. And it was a little... industrial town, actually. It had two shoe factories and a woolen mill, and that's where everybody worked. Usually both people in a family. My mother and father both worked there. It's just a poor working class town. Most people didn't have cars. Most people walked to work. I think at this point I checked to see, it says the population is 5,000. I'm sure it probably was maybe 1,000 or less then, I don't know. But growing up in a really small town like that, for me was, you know, was really quite nice because we knew everybody who lived there, everybody in town. My sister and I would, if we were out and about, everybody knew who we were. They knew whose children we were. They knew if you got into trouble or if you needed some help. It was more of a community than what, you know, small towns are now. But that was in 19, I was born in 29. Mm-hmm. And okay. I grew up there and went to school there up through eight. Well, it would have been eight grades, but the city of Rochester got a new high school with a middle school. Mm-hmm. And by the time I was ready for seventh grade, we were able to go to the big city for our seventh and eighth grade. So that was a big deal. But there were 14 people in my class all through the whole six grades. So we knew each other very well. And my mother and father both worked in the shoe factory for quite a long time. And my mother eventually started doing sewing and alterations and things and was very good at it, and so she was able to stay home and still work.
So you you attended high school in Rochester?
I went to high school in Rochester, seventh and eighth grade, and then high school.
Right.
And I was very fortunate to have a 4-year art major program in the high school I went to, which was, I found, very unusual. In fact, even when my own children grew up, I was very disappointed that, you know, you couldn't get a 4-year art program in any school. In fact, you were lucky if they taught art in some high schools, because they would, those classes would be the first one that got dropped.
To go.
That's true. Anything to do with the arts and culture. So, but I really appreciated growing up in that little town, and I do have to say that I grew up, I was 18 before I ever saw a big city, went to Boston with some friends, and we were absolutely, totally colorless as far as, I mean, I had no idea about any other kinds of groups of people. I knew that they existed, but I never saw a person of color, either Hispanic, Black, Asian, growing up.
Was it just not talked about in your community, out of sight, out of mind?
I guess. I never experienced any of the kind of divisions or different kinds of feelings about people. I didn't even know. I'm sure there must have been people there who were Jewish, but I never heard anything about other people being different from us and how we should feel about them. It was just not not there. So, you know, I was fortunate in that sense. But then when you do, when we moved to Florida, my children experienced a very different world. And they were like in first grade, second grade, whatnot. And then to see the kinds of things that were going on between the races, we moved to Gainesville.
Okay. Did you attend college after
I went
you graduated
to,
from
yes.
high school? Okay.
I applied for a scholarship help and went to Kansas City Art Institute in Kansas City, Missouri for 4 years. My art teacher was very helpful in helping me get some help financially to go for my first year. And then after that, I got a scholarship every year after that, a working scholarship. And I chose to go to Kansas City, Missouri. I could have gone to Ringling, and I had the choice of two or three other places, but I wanted to go as far away as I could so that I could experience something different and also to allay any... If I felt like going home, it would have been impossible. I wanted to make sure that I was going to you know, make a go of it, because it wouldn't be easy for me to come back. It was, you know, Middle West, Kansas City. So I had already a plan when I got there. I had a boarding school, I mean a home, that I had signed up for where I could, I worked there in the cafeteria. It was a place where both guys and girls boarded and went to art school or whatever other college they might go to. So it was good. I was all set up. And then I worked at the school, at the Art Institute in the tea room for my working scholarship. So I felt really good about the fact that I could do it myself, because my father was not very supportive of the idea, because they couldn't support me financially, but he kept saying, what do you want to go to art school for? He said, you're only just going to get out and get married. Said, you know, like, if I'm married, I don't need to know anything, right? You know? I had just very backward ideas, but my mother is always very supportive. So I'd stayed there for 4 years.
Okay.
And graduated.
What medium did you work in primarily?
Well, I really just fell in love with watercolor.
Okay.
And I took watercolor for a couple of years. I did take oil painting. And in fact, you know, I wound up teaching oil painting later in when we moved to Cocoa, Florida, after Bob's got his job at the Brevard Junior College teaching. But and it's easier to teach oil because you can change things.
Right.
If you make a mistake, you can scrape it off. You can cover it up. But watercolor is not so forgiving. But I just love it.
What did you do after you graduated from college? Did you meet your husband in Kansas?
No, I knew him before I went away. I knew him from he didn't go to the same high school I did, but we dated before I left. And then he went into the service. First he was in the Merchant Marine. When he was 15, he forged his birth certificate so he could go in the Merchant Marine. He had five or six siblings, and they were quite poor. And every single one of the boys went into the service. So, and he lost one brother in the Korean War. So he joined the paratroopers, the 82nd Airborne, after he got out of the Merchant Marine. And I used to write to him when I was in Kansas City and he was in the Merchant Marine, I mean, in the Airborne. And so he came out to Kansas City during my senior year, because we never really did forget one another. And he was pretty dear to my heart. Our very first meeting and encounter, we exchanged books. And he always was very much into literature and art and poetry. And And he was a thinker and a doer. So, you know, I never quite forgot him, and I dated other people when I was in art school, but I kept my mind on what I needed to do and said, you know, I'm not going to get serious about anybody. And so we got married after I got out of art school. He came out during my last year and was very supportive, and then I did exactly what my father said. Get married anyway. So...
Were you involved in activism at all in college?
No, not in art school.
Okay.
No, I wasn't.
Okay. How did you and your husband get involved in that?
Well, I think it was mainly, you know, when we came down to Florida, and he got involved at the university during his first year with the Student Group for Equal Rights that had formed. And there was a lot of, well, I think during that time also there were people working on voter registration and trying to help get black people to sign up to vote. And so we met friends who were involved doing that. And so the Student Group for Equal Rights, when they formed on campus, they were called upon to go to Ocala because there was a boycott going on, to boycott the some of the businesses that were refusing to serve African Americans. So my husband, and he was only a student then, but he and a number of other people from the university, some of them faculty members. I remember Austin Creel, one of them. He was a professor in religion. And they went up to Ocala to join the picketers who were picketing on the street, and they picked out every single person from out of town, and mostly white, and arrested them. And so they all spent the night in jail. And so that was the first encounter, and there's history involved somewhere, and I mean documentation and everything. I donated all of my files to the university in 2005.
Okay.
So, you know, all of those things are on record, and eventually I think they're going to digitize and put some of them up. So we had, that was the beginning, and I was working then at the, I got a job on campus at Student Publications.
Hmm.
And so it was, you know, just one of those clerk three jobs or something or other, but it turned out I did all the bookkeeping, and I was in this office where they put out the alligator, and so the editors were coming in and out and carrying. It was really exciting. It was fun. And I met some of the greats. You know, David Lawrence was editor there while I was there, and he went on to be editor of the Miami Herald, and
wow.
And I was there like when President Kennedy was shot. And I guess David had stayed. He used to occasionally stay and sleep right in the office. I'd come into work in the morning and he'd be all disheveled. And so I went in, and he had the ticker thing going where the news was coming over the wire. And they printed out an extra page that day with a black border around it. And I still have the copy.
Hmm.
But it was a really exciting time because I was right there when the news was going out. And this is when you used to have to paste it up.
Yeah.
I'd go in the paste out, you know, and they'd be pasting up the newspaper, and I even helped sometimes do that. But and Don Addis used to be there, and he's the famous cartoonist. He used to do cartoons for the Orange Peel.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then he went to work for the St. Pete Times. And I looked him up once a few years ago. I lived in St. Pete for a few years before I came back to Gainesville, but he's gone now. I just found out I think he died 3 or 4 years ago. A lot of people have left the scene.
And in the 60s, what was the mood like in Gainesville, just being in the South, you know, North Florida?
Yeah. This was it like, I know today it could be stated to be like a little liberal center, you know, in this big conservative North Florida environment. But yeah. What was it like compared to that?
I wish we could see it again.
Really?
It was, yeah, it really was. It was like, you know, Marshall Jones wrote about it. It was like the Berkeley of the South. And I have a video that Erin Pursley made. She was a student here a few years ago. I think she's out in Berkeley now. But she made a film, and that's the name of it, Berkeley of the South. And she made it about the 60s here, and she interviewed different people. And she came and she interviewed me and Carol at our house, and we took her to the 2004 or 5, I think they had a civil rights conference in St. Petersburg that Dr. Arsenault put on down at the St. Pete College. And we took her down there, and she did a really good interview of Marshall Jones, the guy that they booted out of here in the 60s, like they did several professors, like they did my husband, you know. So those were the days, you know. I mean, there was something very electric about it. I mean, you could have you could get huge crowds to come out on campus to hear speakers then, but I don't know what happened. There used to be an SDS. Mm-hmm. Well, there is again now. Mm-hmm. I was happy to see that it's formed. But I've got a picture of the campus of the Plaza of the Americas where it's just thousands of people there when Bill Kunstler came to speak, when my husband was in prison and he came to speak to help raise money for the transcripts. And you couldn't see any campus. It was just all people, wall-to-wall people. It was a very exciting time. And I'd like to see more involvement. I think there's a lot of hope now for the movement to grow as far as, you know, the Occupy. It's a little limp here in Gainesville, I think.
I think that's fair to say.
I think they ought to occupy the campus instead of the
downtown where nobody is paying.
And they have
attention.
So many other events that sort of, you know, it's difficult for them to carry on their regular kinds of concerts and things, but it's got promise. I know when they had the demonstrations when Kofi Bembron was shot, I came to those on campus, and there was, you know, quite a lot of interest.
Good
turnout. But it's hard to get people motivated now. I don't know. But just doesn't seem like people are in touch with. I mean, how did we get to this point is what I wonder, because how do people get in office?
It's scary to think about.
Scott. I mean, and then you hear these people who are running for the presidency talking about establishing a colony on the moon.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Serious, I think.
If you ever get tired of living here on Earth, buy some property up in space.
Yeah, buy space property, according to Newt Gingrich.
That is very conservative and like imperialist. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
But when I did run into this program, this oral history program, I was so excited, and I try to go to these events because I think history, you know, it's very, very important and needs to get told. And they're so intent on keeping everything just they've erased a good part of history, you know, just by keeping it off the radar screen. You can go to St. Petersburg, Florida, and you can ask anybody about Straw Park in 1970 and what happened. They've never heard of it. And it was a huge, huge event. It was COINTELPRO's probably biggest event when they first started out. They came there to smash JOMO, basically, to smash the junta of militant organizations, the black community in St. Pete. And a group of faculty members from the university here, they called it the New University Conference that they used to have here, NUC. They were sort of a progressive group that were trying to establish some dialogue around meaningful issues. And so my husband was a speaker in Straw Park on April 18, 1970, along with a number of other people. And the COINTELPRO had everybody there, plain clothes, the whole district attorney's office, everybody was there. And we were absolutely unaware of the fact that it was being set up like that. They had $90,000 worth of new riot equipment. They had it all ensconced in the museum, the art museum. Straw Park is on the water, so we were surrounded. You couldn't get out. They took our cameras, smashed cameras and everything. They came down on, they made 14 arrests that day, all based on, it was really a pretty nice day, and it was getting late. General Hester, retired General Hester, had spoken. Different people had spoken from the Chicano movement, from the black liberation struggles, somebody from all over the state. It was a statewide conference and rally, and we had a march. And we had marched through town saying, 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want you.
War, yes.
War, and nobody got arrested. So at the end, towards the end, after Bob had made his speech, he said, bring the goddamn war home and start dealing with the problems that, you know, we have here. Mm-hmm. They had a garbage strike going and all of that. Well, what this particular rally did was it brought together all of the different movements, and that hadn't happened before. Mm-hmm. And that was really a threat. So COINTELPRO is going to make sure they took care of that. So they arrested my husband for saying goddamn.
Really? And, that was the charge?
That was what they say they arrested him for, mm-hmm. profanity, because they passed this little city ordinance the day before. So, but the manner in which they arrested him, I didn't see six cops there all day until that particular moment, and then they came. He had sat down on the grass after he made a speech, and they went behind him. And so then they got him for resisting arrest, because when they yanked him up, you know, he resisted. So, and then they started pointing out, the undercover agents pointed out everybody to arrest, and they arrested 14. They were all mostly like students that were community liberation. There was a group called Community Liberation Movement, CLM, and they had one of the Puerto Rican people that they put in a police car, and people came and got him out. Freedom. I mean, there were bricks and rocks and bombs being thrown. I mean, it was, and so, it was a big, big event. And it made a little thing like this big in the newspaper about some rock throwing incident or something. But it was a historical event that day, and my COINTELPRO did it, and they neutralized a lot of the movement. And of course, it got my husband 2 years in prison. So, you know, and the other people had to, you know, spend a lot of money to defend themselves. One guy spent a year in prison.
2 years for profanity?
Well, resisting.
Oh, okay. And resisting. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, those were the days. But see what they did? They got him out of the... he was a graduate assistant at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was teaching here at the university, and that was our means of livelihood. I think he got like $500 a month.
Yeah.
Something like, we had 3 kids.
Wow.
Anyway, so, but they didn't take his pay away from him, but they took him out of the classroom at the end of the term because one of the politicians, senator, I think his name was Tom Slade, said he was unfit for the classroom. So he couldn't teach anymore. And then, you know, after he went to court and they found him guilty, we appealed it, but we had to leave. So we went back up north. 5 years later, we come down so that we can, you know, have the hearing so that we can reduce the charge. And they, it's just like having a trial all over again. They put him in prison. So 1975, he started doing the sentence that he got in 1970.
Wow.
We were up north living up in Maine. So, I mean, you know, talk about activism. I just called up and said, hey, you know, I told my daughter, she was married at the time. I said, move over. We had a shop, an antique shop, that somehow or other we managed to, we figured out how to do something to stay alive, you know? We bought the building, and then we thought, what are we going to do with it? And it was a storefront, so we took stuff on consignment, and that's how I learned what an antique was. And so we had the shop going, and it was paying for itself. So I said, just move over, take over, because I said, I'm not coming back till he comes back.
Mm.
Yeah, 2 years, so then we started to organize. And we organized all over the state. He was in 5 different locations.
He was?
When they had the hearing, he was in Pasco County. It was in Dade City. So he was in jail there for several days until they got him back to St. Petersburg, where the original arrest took place for the straw pie. And he started on a hunger strike. And so he was at St. Petersburg jail, Pinellas County Jail, and I was trying to get the money to get him out, to bail him out. Meanwhile, they moved him in the middle of the night to Lake Butler, to the processing center. But fortunately, some guy called me up in the middle of the night, one of the officers, and said, Mrs. Canny, I can't tell you who I am, but they're taking your husband out of his cell to Lake Butler. I said, thank you very much. I got in my van, and I was in Lake Butler in the morning. They couldn't figure out how I, you know, knew that. But
mm-hmm.
So I followed him everywhere he went. But we had a huge, you know, defense committee. So people started writing letters to the governor. And I had stacks of letters. And the teachers union, the FEA, I think it was, the teachers' union were behind him. So they supported him. They went with me to the governor's office to deliver the petitions. But all of that, you know, that's all just what happened to him. And his time at the university, he didn't teach anymore because they flagged his records. So... we moved back up north, and we got involved with what was going on in Central America,
mm-hmm.
what they were doing in El Salvador, because by then my kids were grown, and my son was very much involved, Michael. He still is. So we decided, we went to the big demonstrations they had in Washington, D.C., and we ran into the people who were involved with the Nicaraguan Solidarity Network.
Okay.
And they had a group that was going to go to show their solidarity with the Nicaraguan people. So we signed up, and we went in 1983. It was. There was about 150 of us. Huge amount of people that went from different parts of the country, but we all went and signed up to go there and work, doing whatever kinds of work that they have you do when you go to on these brigades. And so we pick cotton in Punta Niada, up on the Gulf of Fonseca, where you could look over and see the warships, and you could, and they had, the U.S. had surveillance there, and they had mined the harbor. It was scary, but it was very, very interesting, because at the time the Contra War was going on, and our President Reagan was funding the Contras.
Our beloved president, yes.
So that was my very first time out of the country.
Oh, okay.
I had never traveled before. In fact, I don't think I'd ever flown before either. Anyway, it was very, very exciting, and it was wonderful to see the different cultures, to see how the extended families, there's a sense of community that's lacking here. And I mean, it's going to skip over a little bit, like when my granddaughter, my oldest granddaughter, when she graduated from high school, for graduation, I sent her to Cuba. I'd already been there myself, to the youth conference that they had there. And when she came home, I was just so amazed that she had a little interview with the newspaper, and one of the things she said was, they have something, she says, that we don't have and money can't buy. She's only 18, you know, and she'd never been anywhere hardly in her life. She said it was that, that's what it was. It was that community, that sense of caring about in an extended way, you know, the horizontal kind of, you don't feel it here. It's lost, it seems. I mean, we put old folks here in nursing homes, or and kids are all boarded out, or, I mean, people, it's understandable. I mean, the nature of this people have to work, and you have to have childcare and all of that, but it just seems like there's something lost as far as how we relate to one another that was there at the time. And then, you know, when I hear what they put out, the information here about Cuba and also about Venezuela, you know, the dictators and this and that and the other, and what horrible lives they live. I mean, I saw stuff in Cuba that would make you cry. There were North Americans who went with me to Cuba that, one of them was a doctor from New Hampshire, and he had a sister who was in a mental institution up in New Hampshire, and we went to visit one in Cuba, and he was in tears talking about what he wished that he could see happen with his sister, that you could see there, the kind of programs they had, the way they treated people, the way they treat their elderly, the programs that they have, and free health care and education. And you'll say, well, you must have been duped, you know, like, who was it that was running you around? Running us around, you could see it, you know, it's there. They didn't put it on just for us. We could go anywhere and feel safe during that particular time. I don't know how it is now, like Nicaragua, after they got Ortega out and they destroyed all those beautiful murals. Oh, everywhere you went, there were murals everywhere. And when They got Ortega out, and United States got Shamar in. Mm-hmm. They painted over them. I mean, art is dangerous. Poetry is dangerous.
Right.
It inspires people to be in touch with their humanity, I guess, you know. I mean, it's a tool. It's a, it definitely is. We need to be armed with those kinds of things instead of bombs. And now drones? I don't know. Just babbling, so.
No. Well, we were interested because I came and picked up the poster collection mm-hmm. from you, you know, that spans so many events and so much time. We're really wondering what, you know, the timeline of your life was like with all of those. Like, where did you go and who did you go there with? And
what
was
it like? Oh, I probably didn't go to all of those because that's a collection of, I wish I had, but it's a collection that we've acquired. Like, mm-hmm. my husband went to the Soviet Union in 1987. It was the 70th anniversary, I think. He went with a group, and he really enjoyed it. I have an album of pictures that he took and everything. It was a very interesting trip. I don't think it was very big, maybe 20, 25 people in the group. But he always was interested in seeing other places, other countries, and of course this is before the fall of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to Nicaragua, that was the first time I had been out of the country. And then, and we only went for just, I think it was 2 weeks on that brigade. And it was like 150, but we enjoyed the trip so much that we went home. We took care of business at home, and we planned on going back. We went back the following year in 84, my husband and I, and for 5 months. We stayed 2 months in Costa Rica because we knew some people at home in Portland, Maine, who had a place there, and they rented it to us for 2 months. Then we went from there to Nicaragua for 3 months. So we stayed in Managua, basically, is where we stayed. But we traveled around Nicaragua, and we got to meet a lot of people there that we maintained relationships with. Now, when we were on the brigade, the first time we went to Nicaragua, they took us after we had worked in the fields all week. They took us to the beach, and it was a very strong current that day in the ocean, and there were two people that nearly drowned, and one of them, my husband's a good swimmer. I don't swim in the ocean. I go in and play around a little bit. Well, I was only in up to my knees almost, and I got knocked down, and I said, no, this is it for me, because it just flattened me. And he's out just, so I said, be careful. He's out just enjoying himself. So the woman who was on the brigade with us started in, and I said, he's, I'm worried. She said, don't worry. She said, I was a lifeguard. I said, okay. So she went out to swim with him, and it wasn't too long, and he came dragging in just, and I said, what is it? And they had this body laying on the beach. And he had heard somebody screaming for help. He couldn't understand Spanish, but when he saw the hand that was going under, he went down to get him. And he said, his body looked lifeless, but he said, when I got a hold of him, he grabbed on, so he knew the guy was still alive, but he had to struggle himself to get him up. He got him up and tried to swim with him, and my husband was 60, yeah, it was almost 60 then. So Elaine had gotten there in time to try to help, but my husband was beginning to get exhausted, so some other guy comes along, and Bobo told me, I felt so relieved when this guy says, I've got him, let go. So he comes dragging himself in, and they saved the young man, and he was a soldier in the He was what they call a cachorro, Sandinos, cachorros. And they were on leave that weekend, but they had been fighting the Contra. So, and we got to meet them, and we all enjoyed our successful survival. And so the following year, when we went back, we went to visit his parents.
Oh, wow.
And he was still in the mountains fighting, but they took us in like, oh, they just, we were a family, you know, it was just wonderful. So we established, you know, relationships with the family there and had maintained ever since. And so they're part of my chi, the mother is part of my Outrageous Courageous Women exhibit. I sketched the whole family while I was there, each one, and I couldn't have time to paint them, but I gave them the sketches, but I went and got some copies so that I could have them, and I painted the ones that I brought home. So, and she passed away last year of cancer, but her, the son, the guy that they saved, mm-hmm. lives in Grand Rapids.
Really?
And somehow or other, he, you know, I never did like chat things and Facebook and all of that, but he found my son on Facebook. And so that's why I'm on Facebook, because, oh my gosh, what's he doing in the United States? So now I'm on Facebook.
That's a good start.
You find a lot of people that you, you know, you just haven't kept in touch with for years. So we, you know, we spent those months there, and then we decided we wanted, we got involved in Maine with the Let Cuba Live, the solidarity with the Cuban people. And there was a pastor, Lucius Walker, who did Pastors for Peace caravans to Cuba every year. And they would organize and get humanitarian aid from all over the country, and people would donate vehicles, and you could drive the vehicle, and you had to go to Texas, usually Laredo, or there's another place they used to go to, can't remember, McAllen or something or other. And then they would load the vehicles who were gonna go, also all the equipment, on ships and send it to Cuba, and the people who drove down would fly over and deliver the goods. And we sent school buses and ambulances and whatnot. And so my son went on one of them where the little yellow school bus got impounded in Texas, and they had this huge demonstration where they sat there and went on a hunger strike, and it made a lot of news, and people got arrested and whatnot. But I think my son has been on two or three of them, but we always, at home, had all these demonstrations to support the caravan and also against the Contra War. We had every year in Monument Square in Portland, we had huge demonstrations about Hiroshima. And I mean, anything to do with, you know, what the United States was doing in Central America, mm-hmm. or against the war, and also nuclear power. And we just attended all of those things because, you know, it's gonna get in your blood. What are you gonna do? You can't just let them get away with all this stuff, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So I went to Cuba. We went to Cuba that first time with the Vince Ramos Brigade, and I guess it probably was legitimate. I mean, I think they probably, the Vince Ramos Brigade people got some kind of permission. But the next time I went, well, Bob died that year, the first, well, after we went to Cuba, I went to Mexico to paint for 3 weeks, and I came home, and I was home 3 weeks, and he had the heart attack, and he died. The following year, I went to Cuba again, and I went in opposition to the brigade, to the travel band.
Okay.
So they told us it would be a $100,000 fine or 10 years in prison or whatever, but we said, well, we don't care. We're going to go to Cuba. I went with Carol. I think Carol went. I mean, in my family, Carol Thomas and Liz. And then I went on the third time with my son, Michael. So I've been three times, and so far I haven't been fined and I haven't been put in jail. But when we were coming back, I had my passport stamped, and they would let you have a little thing to put in your passport if you didn't want it stamped, you know, because it might impede. If you travel in other parts of the world, you might be in trouble, but I wanted my stamp. And I held it out at the U.S. Customs to show him, and he wouldn't look at it. He just said, go straight through that door, ma'am, and have a good day. I said, thank you. So, you know, and those three trips to Cuba were, I mean, they're just very, 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 they're life-changing when they were. What they have done in Cuba and how we were treated in Cuba were just in. I mean, I just always wish everybody could experience it so they would see what really it's like in Cuba for the people who live there because of the kind of misinformation you get put out here. You know, this government is just incredible. So that's the reason why we keep on keeping on, because then I came back to Florida after my husband died and lived for 6 years in St. Pete with my son, who had a place there. And we used to join the Immokalee.
The farm workers.
Farm workers and different kinds of demonstrations they had in St. Pete. And I did some artwork down there, joined a little group that grew every week, so that was nice. But I really wanted to come back to Gainesville. I always said, Bob and I always said, we really should go back to Gainesville because they deserve us, you know, because that's where we got our education in spite of the university. So we came back, and Carol Thomas, who I've known since the 60s, because when I first came to Gainesville, she was very much involved in the civil rights struggles. And she had been arrested and jailed and this and that and the other. And so when she was in jail, my husband was the ACLU chairman for the year, and that was the first we ever heard of Carol Thomas. She wrote, wanted some help, get out of jail. So the ACLU tries to do that to, you know, help people who have been unjustly put in prison to begin with. So after she got out, you know, we've just been going at it ever since. It's one thing or another. You can always find a battle that you need to fight. So she moved up to Kentucky. She moved up to Maine with us for a little while. And so we're all back down here. And we live in the same house, Carol and I and Michael. And we still continue to do whatever we can do. Mm-hmm. We've been there for 11 years in Alachua. And we started going to city commission meetings. And we don't miss too many of them. And so we've kind of got our own little local activism going, because you have to stay on top of things in order to keep them from selling everything out, you know? I mean, it's terrible. Just in the 10 years we've been there, what they do with development. Mm-hmm. And regardless of contamination or how it's going to affect people's lives and safety and whatnot. I mean, we live in a beautiful area over there where there's sinkholes and there's springs and there's And, you know, they build big boxes. And they now they're getting ready to give all of our reclaimed water to the biomass plant.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Which I'm really not in favor of. But, you know, you can't do very much, but you can let your voice be heard. But.
Which is more than a lot of people do, that's for sure.
I just don't understand why more people don't, you know, because there's so much apathy, you know. Mm-hmm. We have a brand new city hall over there with a huge, huge chamber auditorium. And there's probably maybe three or four people besides us that go to city commission meetings. It's empty, practically. And, you know, they just kind of run it. I mean, I guess that's what they do. They give them permission to run it. You vote them in, and then you say, okay, do what you want, I guess. I don't know. But then we went to Venezuela in November of 2008. Carol and I signed up to... Well, we didn't go with the brigade. We went with Global Exchange. You've heard of Global Exchange?
No, I haven't. I know the name, but I don't know much else about it.
I forgot all about that trip. Global Exchange, yeah, the year after my husband died, it was 1989, I went to Honduras for Global Exchange. And Global Exchange is a very active group. Medea Benjamin started it. She's very, very active with Code Pink. She's always getting arrested somewhere, Code Pink. And it was the very, very first, or they call them reality tour. So on that first reality tour, we went to Honduras, and we went up to, we went on a little tour up the northern part of the country. I'm trying to remember the name of it. But the conference itself was in Tegucigalpa. And it was the very, very first peace conference that they ever held in Honduras that involved, you know, the popular movement within the country and activists from outside the country. And most of the people who were on the trip that I went on were journalists or authors or, you know, it was only a small group, maybe 15 or 20 of us. Allison Acker was one. She's a Canadian author. There were quite a few. Holly, I can't remember her last name, but anyway, it was a good, very, very good conference. And this dear friend of mine was doing the translating, spontaneous translating. She's very, very good at it, but it was very different from any trip to Nicaragua or Costa Rica. It was heavily militarized. Honduras was, even at that time, worse than it is now. I mean, not as bad as it is now. It's very bad since the coup. But I couldn't take pictures in a lot of places. I was cautioned by people who knew that if I did.
What would you have taken pictures of?
Well, we were traveling around and I saw some sites I would have liked to have seen near them. You know, some kind of a military thing, you know.
Okay.
And because a lot of people don't want their pictures taken either. They just usually try to get permission. But we went to, we had a dance, music, like a little fiesta up north where we had visited the night before we were leaving, and we were all having a really good time dancing. It was a union hall. And the union, some of the union leaders took part in the conference. And all of this, it was a lot of surveillance, military surveillance. So we're all having fun dancing, and the military starts, the door opens and they start coming in, and they just kind of go around, line up around the edges of the wall. And so the person I was dancing with would just dance over to the door, and they kind of passed the word around. We danced over to the door and left. They never said a word. We emptied out. Nobody said anything. That was it. They just came in and intimidated everybody into leaving. It was a very heavy, heavy kind of feeling. You couldn't feel comfortable there. You know, like in Nicaragua, I never felt that feeling at all, even though they were at war. And the Contras were fighting. I always felt safe. We used to hitchhike all over. The army guys would pick us up. And, you know, it was, even though you could expect maybe some attacks from the Contra where we stayed, if we got up in the middle of the night to go to the outhouse, you had to have a guide take you because the perimeter was, they had like a security all around the perimeter. You felt safe, but you didn't know for sure if, you know, they'd bomb you or something. But anyway, it was it was a learning experience. It
sounds like an adventure, yeah. Mm-hmm. Many adventures. Do you have any advice for young activists, like in Gainesville, right now, based on everything that you learned and what you know about Gainesville as it is now?
Well, if they're already an activist, you know, I mean, I've got some advice for young activists, but I mean, you don't know. I think I think maybe one of the best things that can happen to young people is to somehow get some exposure to the history of where they are and how it, I mean, it just seems to me that you would be naturally curious to know what happened here before I arrived, or, I mean, there's so many, we have a friend that we argue with all the time about, well, history, like, what's so important about history, you know, but it's gone, like, but.
I think it would be hard for me to be friends with that person.
Yeah, you know, it is difficult. I just leave the room, usually, you know, it's a waste of time, because, you know, it's, I that's what I tell people I do. I carry my camera and people say, well, and I say, I'm recording history. Mm-hmm. I'm recording history because I've got so many archives. I've got stuff from way back. Mm-hmm. I've still got my report cards from grade school. But history is so important because, and when I think about people, young people today that don't even know about the civil rights struggle, and don't even know, and there were people who watched that Berkeley of the South, they showed it at some place downtown Gainesville, and there were people saying they could hardly believe that actually happened in Gainesville because they had some of these old pictures and clips of when they got tear gas, when people laid down in the street. Mm-hmm. And University Avenue and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it just seems like I've met some really, really great young people at some demonstration, you know? And you go to the School of the Americas up in Fort Benning, Georgia, every year, mm-hmm. and it always amazes me how many young people and old people, there's a lot of old people, they keep going back. I've only been there 3 times. I can't afford to go every time. But you know, to see the young people get turned on and so excited about the fact that, you know, this enthusiasm about changing things. And now with the Occupy movement, it seems to me that people are beginning to, if only it could, if this, there's going to be some kind of outrage, you know, because you go down to the Diddley Plaza, it's the same people over and over and over, which that's good. Mm-hmm. They don't, I guess, you know, quit. Maybe some of them have. But how are you going to reach? You could in school if they'd allow you to teach. My daughter's a teacher, a school teacher. I was up Maine last summer, and I was really amazed that my granddaughter actually got interested in talking about what was going on as far as the movement is concerned, because she's been so self-centered and so into what, you know, how her hair looks, or whether or not to get a tattoo or something. And I think, wow, you know, I'm so lucky I've got my own kids. Mm-hmm. Have my daughter, she's a teacher, but I mean, she's always been very, very supportive. My kids have been so supportive. They've never ever said to me, why did you do that? Because I could have had this or had that. Or, I mean, we just gave everything to it, you know, and my husband lost his job and we never could afford to send him to college or doing. My daughter worked her way through. Mm-hmm. And it was that important to her. But I guess I'd tell them that they ought to, I don't know, wake up. Dan Berger wrote a really good book about the movement, and also there's a little book that he wrote of his advice of letters to young people and young people in the movement. I think he's a graduate of the university. I'm not sure. I saw him here at the public library when he spoke, and I've got the book. There's some good books out for people to read. If people will read books, I don't know, maybe a Kindle. I still like to turn pages. But what would you tell them? How can you get them together so that they can understand that it's really up to them? Because I feel sorry for the young people. I feel really sorry for my great-grandchildren. I don't know what's ahead for them. I'm not going to be around to see it. But, you know, I feel responsible. I feel that, you know, we are responsible for what's going to happen to them. Mm-hmm. And they deserve better. They deserve for people to stand up and do whatever they have to do to change things. How did it get to be this bad? I mean, it's really, and it's not so bad that we can't change it. When, you know, people say, well, what can you do? They used to tell me, some of my friends, well, what's your cause now? You know, like, how did you happen to get involved? The fact that I live, I mean, I was born this way, I guess, because, you know, I didn't choose. I didn't say, oh, I think I'm going to be a political activist. You know, I mean, just by virtue of the fact that you see what you see around you in the way of injustice. Mm-hmm. And if you can't stand up against that, and we always say we want peace, but we want peace with justice, because, you know, it's not worth anything without justice, and there isn't any. I mean, it's hard to come by because of the powers that be, and I guess it's the corporations now, I don't know. That's what they say, that if we could get rid of the corporations.
I could talk for half an hour about how much I agree with you.
Move to a man. Yeah. Yeah. They've got to do it. But I think the only way that you can ever get anything done is to, you know, you have to rebel. You have to be in the streets. I agree with Howard Zinn. He says, you know, civil disobedience, you know, like, that's the problem. We're too obedient, you know. I guess you have to be really, really terribly affected by whatever. If it's not happening in your backyard, or if it's not happening to you, but, you know, what people don't seem to understand is what's happening everywhere, you know, it's going to impact on you sooner or later. I mean, we're only in denial if you think otherwise. And I noticed it said on there, what's my, you know, like, what
contribution.
Do you think is your biggest achievement or contribution? don't know. I think it's the fact that I feel that the fact that I survived is is a wonder, but also, I guess, you know, what I can say I feel the best about is the fact that I know so many people, and especially my own children, who are gonna, I know, are gonna continue the struggle mm-hmm. and carry on. And I would hate to think that I would feel like in my passing that that's the end of it, because it isn't. It won't be, because I've got whatever it is that they got from, you know, growing up in this culture and having the kinds of experiences that they've had as a result of it, and having the chance to get the consciousness that they've got, I guess it's kind of special, because apparently it's not too easy to come by from what I observe. You know, I mean, for people to have the consciousness that you need in order to say that you're going to stand on principle and you're going to speak up for what you believe in, and that you won't tolerate injustice anywhere. You know, I can count on that with some of the folks that I know, and that's really encouraging. And so when people say, well, how come you're still doing that? I say, well, what else is there to do? I mean, what are you supposed to do? What's the other side of the coin? You know, I mean, I want to know when I go that I'm going down on the right side of history, because that's important. And I don't know, I guess, what is there? What more is there? Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, I've never really felt like I've done anything special. I'm just living my life and trying to make a better world as possible, at least. And not just for a few people. I think it should be for everybody. What more?
That's a good message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that we are one thing. You know, if people could only get that, because, you know, we've been going to Kali Blount's African History mm-hmm. at the Civic Media Center. Mm-hmm. You know, you never told to learn. I mean, that's just incredible. And that history is supposed to be taught by mandate. There was a law passed in the public schools, and there's only 5 counties, I think he said, in Florida that implemented it. And he has worked so hard all these years to try to get it in the schools. Well, he's giving these lectures, and I think the next one is number 5 or maybe 6. But when you get through, you understand that we all are descendants from Africa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, that's kind of a neat thing to know. Mm-hmm. It really is. It's, I mean, why there's so much division and so much killing and, I mean, the hate crimes and things that are happening here just because somebody's a different color or a different... Where does it come from? Because it's happening quite frequently now. Mm-hmm. We have to do something about it. Mm-hmm. This is really quite a different... a different interview than what I planned. I didn't
really.
I didn't know. I mean, I didn't plan anything. I just didn't want to ramble.
No, it's been great. It's been very informative.
I think so.
And I think it'll be a really useful contribution to our archives here, because, you know, we here at the program kind of put that emphasis on getting involved, and having an interview like this hopefully will just motivate people even more, being able to listen to this and hear about your life and what you've done.
Yeah, it's the point of oral history, is that subjectivity and finding out people's personal motivations.
Yeah.
Thoughts.
Well, it just seems like there's so much, you know, that, you know, to try to, I always feel like, oh, I should have said this, or I should have talked about that, but, you know, I'm just looking forward to more, what should I call them, triumphs, I guess. I mean, these battles, we're going to win some of them. We're going to win quite a lot of them, and that's what I am really, I'm heartened by the fact that the Occupy movement, when I watch it everywhere, I, you know, up in Maine and here and there and everywhere, and the kind of dialogue that's coming out, the things that people are beginning to talk about and discuss that have been swept under for so long. I mean, I think that it's here to stay. I just can't see them going away. I can't see this movement just being neutralized or swept away like they did, you know, in the 70s when the COINTELPRO came and just really did practically neutralize the whole movement of people against the war. And they have a way of doing that because, you know, people's livelihoods are at stake. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do?
Yeah,
but when you feel like you're all in the same boat, where else are you going to go? There are people, you know, occupied that don't have any place to go. Mm-hmm. And where are the guys going, the people going when they come home from Afghanistan and Iraq? They have no place to go. Mm-hmm. So they need to get together and make a new revolution, I guess. You know, I mean, I've always said that's what I'm waiting. I just hope I can see it before. I said, you know, I think I see in the beginning of what I'm hoping to see before I pass. Mm-hmm. Because that's what we need.
Right.
Every time I ever have a chance to raise a toast, I say, here's to the revolution. And it doesn't have to be bloody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they talk about it being bloody. I mean, it's bloody now. We don't, you know, life is bloody for people every day.
Mm-hmm.
We just need to get together and change it.
Definitely. Yeah, that's what we got to work on. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say for the record or stuff you remember?
I'd just like to say thank you, especially for this wonderful oral history program here, because it got me turned on the first time I went to one of these things. And there's so much history that needs to be told that I hope that you just, you know, keep doing it and that people get exposed to it somehow. Mm-hmm. So that they come to these events, because I think that's what's going to help turn young people on.
Mm-hmm.
I met some young people at one of the first events, and I was really quite excited about the fact that they were so enthusiastic about the program and what they were doing. And it's really heartening to see that people are beginning to take interest in this history that's been, you know, hidden for all these years, like the history of the civil rights movement here, and the women's movement. I enjoyed that panel that they had. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited to see people like you working on this program.
Thanks.
And if I could in any way help support it, I would. And I have lots and lots of archives.
Yeah.
Of games.
Sounds like that'd be some researcher's dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was looking at stuff. I've been going through it. And so, you know, but you'd really have to come to my house.
Mm-hmm.
I did like your house. Yeah. It's a great, great, huge room.
My file cabinet's full of, you know, different professors that have been wasted. And, yeah. There's a lot of good stuff there. I don't throw anything away.